Hello there, I'm Luke Clancy, and you're listening to Culturefile. And honestly, I can't help but feel you're making good choices in this period. This session, we're going to explore the spiritual calling that is running a rave with mask promoter Skemon Draymon. We are leafing through the granddaddy of all nature writing with a book from the same year as the French Revolution on Paddy Woodworth's Naturalist bookshelf, and we encounter the sylvan sci-fi of Cecilia Donnell in an exhibition at Solstice in Navan, but we begin with The Unfinished in the latest from filmmaker Tygo Sullivan's trips into the netherworld of artworks that never got completed.
At film festivals, about an hour before a screening, it's common for the filmmaker to be ushered into the empty auditorium to check their film. The cinema's technical team will play a section or two from the movie, and often there will be a bit of hand-waving and gesturing up to the projectionist's booth to make tiny adjustments to the sound levels, followed by a big thumbs up. Often, someone will tell the story of how the great director Stanley Kubrick would telephone cinemas from his home to check that his work was being presented as intended. In reality, these tech checks are usually a case of indulging the filmmaker's nerves. Films are mastered to very strict and meticulous standards. Indeed, the process of finishing and delivering a film is so tediously detailed and prescribed that by the time it reaches a cinema, it has been checked by a great many eyes, ears, and machines. But is something lost in this certainty, this high degree of quality control? I got to thinking about the films that never made it to that final finishing process, and what they might tell us about the very nature of cinema, and called up the film scholar, curator, and writer Colm McAuliffe, who happens to know a lot about this very subject.
When we see a film on screen, we assume, rightly probably, that it is the finished version. I began to think, what if it isn't? What if the audience needs to be the final aspect in making a film or any art form finished? I was very interested in the work of Mika Levy, who's a film composer who had done the score for Under the Skin and was also at the time, I think, Oscar nominated for the score for Jackie. I was friends with Mika's sister, Francesca, who is a fantastic filmmaker, a very, I suppose, DIY filmmaker. And by that, I mean she had this tendency to go to car boot sales around the UK and find completely random VHSs of home movies and all sorts of things. And she would digitize them and she would create completely new projects out of these things that she had found. So I spoke to Francesca about this idea of unfinished projects, and she was really interested in coming on board, and she asked Mika to come on board as well. So we went to a Wetherspoons in South London and we started thinking about films that were unfinished and films that maybe had never been made and ideas that they both had had that had never reached fruition. We found a common ground in the Armenian film The Colour of Pomegranates, which was directed by Sergei Parajanov.
That's a very finished film, though.
It's a very, very finished film. They said that they had always wanted to do a version of that film, reimagining it as if it was based in Blackpool in the north of England, rather than, you know, 18th or 19th century Armenia. And they'd never actually quite got to the point of finishing that project. So we decided this could be the opportunity for us all to collaborate on this idea of The Colour of Pomegranates, which would now become The Colour of Chips, because they felt that chips was a more appropriate signifier of Blackpool than pomegranates. And so Mika got together work from film projects that they hadn't completed, and that became the source of the soundtrack. And Francesca got together various VHS things that she had picked up. These would have been separate unfinished projects. And we put that all together and created this thing called The Colour of Chips.
And showed it.
We ended up getting a lot of funding from the Arts Council of England for this concept, and the concept was called The Unfilmables. And the whole basis was unfinished films, bringing unfinished films to life. you know, there's a multitude of unfinished films out there, some of which are very, very famous. Mika and Francesca's film was one example of that. And another example of that was an unfinished film called The Tourist.
From what era?
Claire Nota wrote it, I think, in the early 1970s. And it was a film ostensibly about these aliens who come to New York, a sort of a dystopian version of New York, and they're completely starved of sex. And so they spend their entire time in these dingy sex clubs in Manhattan in the sort of late 1970s, but also a kind of a futuristic 1970s. So there was loads of people attached to that film, like Kim Basinger, Theresa Russell, Sharon Stone, Michelle Pfeiffer, Scorsese, and Coppola, but it went through so many different iterations it never ever got made. But when pitching this idea to a few people I knew, a guy called Stephen Malander, who was one of the main people in Cabaret Voltaire, who were the pioneers of electronic music from Sheffield, he was really interested in doing something with the existing script of The Tourist. So he collaborated with a director named Tash Tung, and they went around North London and they tried to recreate what they thought this film, The Tourist, would have looked like. Stephen Malander from Cabaret Voltaire, he read aspects of the script over the top of these images that were created to create, I suppose, a speculative vision of what The Tourist could have been like.
And kind of subverting the whole idea of a finished thing.
We really wanted to subvert the idea of a finished project. The film would be played live, it would also be manipulated live by a sort of a live VJ, and the music would also be performed live, so that it left a lot of freedom for interpretation, so the audience could decide how they wanted the narrative of this film to be, how they wanted the conclusion to be, how everything intersected with each other was entirely open-ended and open to interpretation. The whole concept behind it was that these were unfinished projects and they were still being unfinished projects, and we were presenting them as unfinished projects.
Remember, 5, 4, and 3 are your lucky numbers, but quit while you are ahead.
The Unfilmables is a concept. It worked very well for a certain period of time, but I think I got frustrated with reading too much about unfinished projects, because my ego took over and I thought, if I read too much about too many unfinished projects, all of my projects will be infiltrated by this concept of things being unfinished. And I really felt like I had to step away from that world in order to complete projects that I needed to do. So I was very glad to do it for a certain period of time, to be engaging with this notion of the unfinished. It was also something I wanted to move away from.
You're writing a novel now?
Writing a novel now, show band era, Ireland in the late 1960s. I think in some ways a very progressive, a very forward-thinking time. I'm very keen to depict an Irish town on the cusp of modernity.
Will you finish it?
Nope. We'll see how it goes.
When I started kind of working with the area where I grew up, I just felt like something immediately just clicked into place. Like, I felt like this is my landscape that I can describe. So my name is Cecilia Danell. I'm a Swedish-born Galway-based artist, and I work mainly with painting. But I also have, in recent times, I've been working with sculptural installation, textiles, and film as well. As a Swedish person, I've always been very sort of interested in the landscape where I grew up in the Swedish countryside. Like, we always used to kind of play out in the woods kind of near the house, and we'd go for kind of walks with the parents as kids. And so I suppose for a number of years, I've decided to deal with kind of like a type of landscape that describes my own kind of inner landscape. So my way of working is basically to return to Sweden, to the region where I grew up, and walk in the landscape and gather research material. And sometimes I can see kind of straight away when a work is going to become a painting. I kind of envisage it already when I'm there on site. And other times I go through research material, but it's really important for me to have like a first-hand experience of a place, of walking there, what it kind of looked like around that scene, and just having an experience of an encounter in the landscape and then trying to translate that through paint. So what I usually do is I set out on these forest walks in Sweden, originally branching out from my family farm, but then over the years I've gone kind of further and further afield. So it's basically a case of going off for a few hours. I usually bring a flask of coffee, bring my SLR camera, and I just spend a few hours kind of walking. I often know like a rough route, but I leave it open to kind of encounters within the landscape, like things that kind of draw me in and things that I want to paint. A lot of times it can be something that actually has a kind of sculptural quality within the landscape. It can be an arrangement of rocks or branches, or it can be a type of texture that I feel really drawn to documenting through paint, like mossy rocks or certain type of colours and textures that I just feel like it would be a challenge for me to try and render those through painting. So that often draws me in. There can also be things like kind of remnants of human activity within the landscape. Like sometimes I come across these hunter's blinds that are left to decay in the landscape, or there could be a forest that is cut down and the kind of remnants of that. Or a lot of times it's just something that sort of intrigues me about an arrangement within the space that I feel kind of lends itself to painting. I'm very, very interested in what kind of describes your own kind of inner landscape and psychogeography and things like that. And I think most people have a type of a landscape that they really closely identify with. And sometimes it has to do with where you might have lived earlier in your life or where you're living at the moment. And some people really identify with the seaside or with kind of open space. But for me, it's always been the forest. And for me, the forest is something welcoming, like it's not sinister, and it's also kind of has a certain mystery to it, because you can't get an overview of the place. You're kind of discovering things as you go along.
You mentioned psychogeography there. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, like the psychogeographers would have been people in the 1800s in Paris who kind of walked around in the streets, kind of like aimlessly in a sense, to try and have an experience, like an encounter that was really like unexpected, and just like to see what they found, and then try to use that kind of knowledge for artworks and for writing and for things like that. So it was always about kind of like encountering a place and kind of seeing what it would kind of give you. But it's also to do with the idea of places connecting with you in certain ways. And I think like I've always been very connected to the type of landscape that I'm painting over in Sweden. But as I go along, I suppose I've been very inspired by like say science fiction narratives and ideas about like our place in the world and the state of our planet. And these kind of different things can be played out with this particular landscape that exists in real life as a backdrop. And I think I've also been very interested in the human need to kind of project things onto the landscape. You know, we've always gone out into nature to try and restore us and to try and get something from nature, whereas I feel that nature is kind of just being itself, but we're kind of hoping that it can do all these different things for us. So that's something that I'm very interested in as well, that whole idea of what we expect from a place and what it actually is in and of itself, and to try and recognize that as well. So in the exhibition space, there's a film called Snow Day, where I'm walking through the snowy woods with a gimbal, like a handheld camera device. I was just so mesmerised by the idea that the snow just absolutely just changes the landscape so much. I mean, even walking in the woods where I would know my way, like no problem normally, actually felt completely different, and I nearly got lost in it, because everything just gets really abstracted when the snow falls on it. And I just started kind of isolating these kind of abstract shapes, and I started making a series of ceramic sculptures which are displayed, and they're called the Snow Museum, because I'm also very conscious of climate change and how the winters are getting milder, and even somewhere like Sweden, like the winters are milder than they were before. And so that's like an important part of the exhibition for me, because it's something that I've been thinking about for quite a long time and working with and returning to the landscape in the winter, like on a few occasions, just to kind of document snow and things like that. It's like a speculative fiction take on the idea of climate change, where I'm basically proposing these artifacts that are like ceramic objects that could be maybe in this imaginary snow museum in the future when there isn't actually any snow left, so people can go and look at these objects and kind of imagine what snow looked like.
If there is one volume on the naturalist bookshelf that can claim to be the mother and father of all the rest, it has to be Gilbert White's The Natural History of Selborne. It first appeared in the year of the French Revolution, 1789, and has been published more than 300 times since in English, a record probably only beaten by the Bible, Shakespeare, and John Bunyan. Its fans include Coleridge, Darwin, W. H. Auden, and Virginia Woolf. Yet it is a most unlikely bestseller, being a series of letters by a rural Anglican clergyman about the natural phenomena of a single and not particularly remarkable Hampshire village. Nor is it an easy read, at least at first sight, often lacking any systematic structure whatsoever. It frequently hops from one subject to another, like the crickets White studied so assiduously. I have dipped into it for years, but only read it from cover to cover for the sake of this programme. My guilt at this negligence was somewhat assuaged by finding a passage in Richard Mabey's biography of White, in which this great contemporary nature writer confesses, "I could not cope, at first, with its rambling disorder, its sudden plunges into thickets of taxonomic Latin, and, for a while, I failed to notice the feeling behind the often dispassionate prose." Mabey was wrong, and I was wrong. White often draws conclusions from his extraordinarily precise observations that are still startlingly accurate today. This makes his recurrent misconceptions all the more vivid reminders that he is, in fact, of another age than ours. Chief among these misconceptions is his obsessive struggle with the notion of migration, especially among the Swallow clan. No sooner has he established, from a correspondent in Andalusia, the book is remarkably cosmopolitan for a village diary. No sooner has he established that swallows undoubtedly migrate in seasonal swarms back and forth across the Straits of Gibraltar than some early or late appearance of a swallow in Selborne convinces him that this individual, at least, must be hibernating nearby. Yet what he is doing here has the rudiments of good science. Confronted repeatedly with apparently conflicting evidence, he advances one hypothesis and tests it again and again against another. And there are no better chapters in this book than those monographic sections which describe, in detail one is tempted to call loving, the locally observable lives of the barn swallow, house martin, sand martin, and swift. His powers of observation were quite exceptional. His notes on swifts are exemplary and also convey a sense of his remarkably accomplished style, coupled with a discreet sexual frankness. "If any person would watch these birds of a fine morning in May," he writes, "as they are sailing round at a great height from the ground, he would see how, every now and then, one drop on the back of another, and both of them sink together for many fathoms with a loud, piercing shriek. This," he continues rather coyly, "I take to be the juncture when the business of generation is carrying on." He was quite right about this extraordinary observation, and nobody, to my knowledge, had seen this phenomenon of sky mating previously. Indeed, it would take the invention of zoom lenses centuries later to prove the point. The book is structured loosely round White's chatty but serious letters to two other distinguished gentlemen naturalists, Thomas Pennant and Daines Barrington. But as he began, very slowly, to conceive of the idea of a single publication, he started to invent undated letters to fill out the gaps in the overall picture of Selborne he was painting. This applies, in fact, to the first 9 letters, supposedly to Pennant, which give a very detailed account of the geology, soil, and general geography of his parish. And these chapters grant him another title, as a father of British ecology, since they set a context in which all the phenomena of nature are linked intimately together, with soil, microfauna, insects, all fundamental to the other species an area can support. And he concludes the book with a series of chapters on local weather, some of which contain the germs of modern geology in a keen awareness of the impact of weather on landforms. We can also credit White as a father of citizen science, since it is clear that he relies heavily on the reports of local gentry, and indeed of yeoman farmers and labourers, on the dates of appearances of particular species and other natural events on his parish patch. So in some respects, this book is a collaborative endeavour, but it is cemented by the vision, in every sense, of one man who found everything in nature fascinating, from the contrasting ways in which squirrels, mice, and nuthatches open nuts to the behaviour of his farmyard poultry. Given the book's antiquity, many of the species names and other references will be obscure to contemporary readers. So it's worth seeking out the edition edited and annotated by Anne Secord for Oxford University Press in 2013 to minimise these minor frustrations.
My name is Skaemon Draemon, aka the Scheme and Demon. I'm in charge of House of Hibernia, cultural events programmer and curator of sorts. When it comes to the spaces, the first thing I would do is check out the location, check the neighbours, check if it's like viable for people to get to and from, and if not, have to hire a coach, then see the pricing of that. Then maybe 2 to 3 weeks before the event, I'll go over and any nail that's sticking out of the wall, hammer in, put railings in every place I don't want anyone to go into. Keep the crowd informed as to what they're getting themselves into.
How's it going? We're Sultan Leroy. Shout out House of Hibernia. Free Palestine.
Last time we did the warehouse, there was an abandoned car. It was a Jaguar that got burnt out. It used to be owned. Actually, I can't tell you who owns it because I'll give away the space. But yeah, we painted that to match the Hibernia colours. I brought in this massive 6-foot cake, made a piñata, had different things like that, just dressing the space. So that's the fun aspect. And then afterwards, the de-rigging, getting all the equipment back in a van, trying to get that all home, and then cleaning everything, putting it all in the black bags, bringing them home, sorting out the cans, and then bringing them for recycling. And yeah, that's kind of the comprehensive overview from beginning to end. You donate, then you'll get an email from Skaemon, me, and it'll ask you for your phone number to be added to the group chat, which is not the announcement group chat, but the one specific to the event. And then you just have to wait to find out the pickup location, and you never find out the actual location. The guards do show up sometimes, but typically they're just astounded, first of all, that no one runs away, because I always tell everyone that an innocent person doesn't run away from a crime scene. They're also astounded by the production that's been put into it, whether it's the lights and like the curtain or what have you, the stages and the box and the bin bags everywhere and all this stuff. They're also shocked that no one's on yokes. You know, there's no jaws swinging, there's no lads with their tops off sweating. There's just like a lot of art students with chalk on their hands, you know, wearing berets. I think they're just doing their job because they heard a noise complaint, and we're just trying to have fun because we're trying to seize our 20s. When the guards turn up, I go over to them straight away, and first they're like, who are you and what's going on? I go, I'm in charge of everything. I hired all the equipment. I'm responsible for everyone here. I got everyone here and I'm getting them all home. And then they're like, what? And then they're like, what's your name? And I tell them my name. And then they're like, you do realize what you're doing is a crime. And I go, no, could you please tell me what crimes I've committed so then I could amend whatever error I've made, because I'm sincerely, like, apologetic. And then they're like, we had a noise complaint, you're disturbing the, you know, the neighbourhood. And I'm like, okay. Well, I didn't realise that. I thought, like, the volumes were at control level. You see, we're not playing dance music, it's live music. So, look, I can get everyone to leave, but if you could guarantee me at least one song to at least have a buffer before we let everyone out, that would be great.
I don't understand. You make demands for how it stands. Some sort of macho man.
And then they're just kind of in disbelief that I've asked them to keep going. And they're like, no, you have to stop now. And I go, look, everyone's looking over at us. If they see that I'm stressed and that this is going to go bad, they're all going to run. Whereas if I tell everyone to chill out, they finish their song, or we do another one, I tell everyone, right, this is the end of the night, the guards are going to oversee everything, and then we're all going to peacefully make our way to the bus stop, and we're all going to put our rubbish in the bags I've provided for everyone and be grand. And then typically the guards do let that happen, and they stay and they see how peaceful everyone is, and they're pretty chill about it.
Yeah, yeah.
The mask comes from Cusco in Peru, and it was brought over by my grandmother. In the beginning, it was kind of difficult to get people used to it, because girls in particular were quite scared if a lad just came at them, like not came at them, but walked past them wearing a balaclava and, you know, in the dark woods. But now it's kind of been incorporated in a lot more playful sense. But I remember wearing it as a kid, and I felt like it gave me a superpower or something. I was a big, very big fan of wrestling growing up, and yeah, I just loved wrestlers. I loved Rey Mysterio, I loved Nacho Libre, I loved all that kind of silly, goofy Mexicana. I asked my mom for a lend of them, she still hasn't seen them since, and she still gives out to me every time, being like, oh, I want them back. I went to go see my granny in Barcelona at the start of the year, and she brought me a couple more, so expect to see them over the next while. First lockdown, moved into this shed. It was the back of a lady's house, and she was rented to, I think, like six other people at the time. And at that point, I wasn't speaking to my family, and I'd kind of fallen out of love with music, and I fell into Muay Thai. And I was training that 4 to 5 times a week, and I was obsessed. Just sitting in bed, literally seeing stars over your head at the end of the night, exhausted from like a very long training session. And then that kind of got pulled with the preceding lockdown, and they closed the gym. And I remember just being in bed, just feeling as if I didn't have a family, didn't have a tribe, didn't like the place I was living, was getting paid by the state to do nothing. I had no purpose or reason to be alive. I kept getting these awful dreams, and I was just like, you know what, why not? I'll just eat these mushrooms that I have in my drawer. I'll just eat them and they'll keep me distracted. And I fell asleep. I fell asleep with the speaker beside me. And when I woke up, it was just, I got loyalty, got royalty. It's the Kendrick Lamar song. And then without even thinking, I just crawled across the room and just ate the rest of the Mexicanas that I had. And then I went on this trip, and in the back, I could hear my mom's voice giving out to me. I was like, you know, I don't care. I don't know. I'm kind of struggling with spirituality and faith at the moment, but I think whatever it is that created everything spoke to me, and it kind of was outlining a plan for me. He was kind of like, look, you're feeling the way you're feeling because, number one, you have no tribe, you have no sense of community, you don't do anything for other people, you don't care for other people, you know, you're not like uplifting anyone, you're not showing any value to the people around you. So you need to take care of other people and look at what you can give to the world. You need to create something, just anything. Those kind of commandments, I suppose, led to the eventual path that I'm on now. And yeah, I haven't looked back since. Final Frontier is taking place in a secret location September 6th. It features 11 acts across 2 stages. It's a completely grassroots independent festival. And yeah, it's been something I've been working on for a very long time, and I can't wait to share with the world.
Skaymon Draymond there in a mix by Louis Scully, and that brings to a close this edition of Culture File. You also heard this week Niamh Daly's mix with Cecilia Donnell about her exhibition at Solstice in Navan, Tyge O'Sullivan on Unfinished Films, and Paddy Woodworth on Gilbert White's The Natural History of Selborne. Culture File is a Sounds Doable production for RTE Lyric FM. Bye now.